We're not ready yet.
Blog Talk Radio.
Let's do this.
This is All About Wine.
All About Wine.
Talk show dedicated to the wine industry since 2009. Featuring winemaker, cellar master, vineyardist, and tasting expert, Ron.
Basically, what we're trying to do in this program is just trying to educate people and trying to make wine less confusing and more friendly.
From coast to coast and around the world.
You know, we really have had some neat people on the program. I love that.
Post your questions and comments during the live show on our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. Again, that's www.facebook.com/allaboutwinebtr. And now, All About Wine is on. Here's Rob.
Thank you, bus people.
Stop at 2:00.
They're excited. It's nice weather and it's not raining right now. Yeah.
Not yet. I haven't even checked tonight's radar. It's ridiculous before. Let me see if I can pull up the radar. Yeah. In the All About Wine weather radar studio for Florida. Let's see. Yeah, see, it's all like I'm right in the center of it, and it's moving away. Like the stuff that comes from your state comes towards us, fizzles out, and then picks up on the other side. I don't know why.
That's sort of like good. It doesn't interfere with electronics or anything. But
yeah, especially that hail that was. Did you see the photos from Melbourne? I think it was.
My gosh! Yeah.
Yes, it looked like it snowed out there.
It was unbelievable the amount of hail they got. And you have to think, this type of this time of year it's warm, and to still get hailstones that large and as they're coming down, it's just something.
Yeah, so. It's not normal for us to get that kind of hail.
No,
they talked about it. They said, we normally get the quarter size or the pea size or something like that, but when you start seeing softball size and
That's reserved for up north. That's us. I mean, it's just that's strange weather in here. Let's see. I just pulled up radar here too while we were talking. Let's see what I've got. Ooh, I got some nasty stuff out in the Gulf heading this way. It's all around you. I can see that too.
Keep it away from us.
Yeah, we really got some big storm front. But it's supposed to rain all day tomorrow, so that's probably tomorrow half the night and into the morning. So that's the storm coming at us right there. Ooh, that's nasty too. All sorts of red in the middle of it and everything. But glad I don't have anything to do tomorrow. Emmeline's on the phone, on hold here. We were sitting there talking about the weather, and I didn't notice her. We do have a guest tonight, Emmeline Zale. I believe I'll have her pronounce it properly for me. She is the managing partner and sommelier of Silver Apricot in New York City, West Village. And she's going to tell us a whole bunch of stuff because she has had a very eventful life, and we'll find out all about it here in a moment. So welcome to All About Wine, Emmeline.
Thank you so much.
Your last name is pronounced what?
Zhao.
Zhao. Wow,
you got it pretty close.
Okay, I
think it's like a first because we're known for chopping names and cities and everything up. So I'm surprised we got close
to it. It's okay. It's the effort that counts, right?
There you go. Okay. That's not it. Yeah. Okay. You have like I just said, telling people, you have had quite an eventful life. Tell us about that. Tell us about, you know, where you were born and what all you did and everything to get up to this point.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
We only have an hour.
I know. That's, I was looking at some stuff on you, and it's just, it's amazing what all you've done.
Oh, you're very kind. I think it's all a product of being a little bit of a lost soul. So that makes things interesting. But to answer your question, you know, I was born in Wisconsin. My family, my parents moved out of there before, you know, when I was a baby. So I don't really remember much of it. Moved to a few different other places before we landed in North Carolina, where my dad was a professor at Carolina. Spent a lot of my childhood hopping between North Carolina and Shanghai, where my extended family is from.
Oh, and so is your mom or dad?
Both my parents are from Shanghai. They came to the States in the 80s as graduate students and stayed. And so I had a lot of my, you know, my parents had their families back in Shanghai. So we spent a lot of summers there. I actually went to school there for a few years, which is a very different thing, by the way. Going to school in China is no walk in the park.
You know, I mean, you hear stuff throughout your life about how tough they are and how strict they are and how competitive they are. And it's true then, I guess, huh?
Oh, it is very conditioning and formative. Let's just put it that way.
Wow.
It was definitely an unusual experience for a child.
How old were you when you were going to school there?
I was there for a couple of years just in preschool and then a couple of years in elementary school. So I was there for second and third grades. Very kind of funny story about my defiant personality as a child was, you know, I went into the school in the second grade, but was not reading or writing at a second grade level in Chinese, because English is my first language. And so the school wanted to send me back to the first grade. And I remember being in the principal's office and I told my mom, not knowing that this was not a possibility, but I told my mom in front of the principal, if they don't keep me in the second grade, I'm going back to America.
Just like that.
Just like that. Didn't matter if it was possible or not. And
you were going, yeah.
I was going to put myself on a plane and survive as a child in the second grade in the States by myself.
Yes.
But the teacher, you know, was afraid, or the principal, I'm sorry, was afraid of losing the tuition money. So she acquiesced and allowed me to stay in the second grade. And it was hard. You know, I spent a lot of time catching up and I actually ended second grade at the top of my class. From the very bottom. So, you know, it was one of those, I think I remember that very clearly because I think about who I am now and realize that as much as I am formed by my experiences, it also is very much a function of my personality from just by nature, I guess. That was something that was kind of wild as a kid. My teacher was my host mom.
Oh, wow.
Who is that crazy to just have no separation from their teacher?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And this one falls into a whole new category there, you know.
Yeah, big time. And definitely, you know, being in restaurants was certainly not, you know, it wasn't something that I'd ever imagined doing, particularly for a child of immigrants. I finished out the rest of school in North Carolina. Being that my father was a professor at UNC, I don't know how much you guys know about or follow college basketball.
All the time. time
okay,
to
great.
Sports fan.
So,
yeah, big time.
Okay, perfect. So you know that I shouldn't have gone to Duke, but I did. And that was a...
yeah, I saw... Yeah, it's funny, I was reading reading your profile here on the Silver Apricot website, and it was talking about Chapel Hill, and then I saw Duke, and I'm going, did she really do that? It's just,
yeah. I did. That I did. It was a big point of contention. My parents... very much supported me on an academic and you know, on that level. But when it came to sports, March is not a month during which we speak.
Yeah, I can imagine. And where's your loyalty lie? Still with, well, who?
Well, you can't go to Duke and not be a Duke fan. It was my freshman year was, it was a period of transition to, you know, I will admit and put this on the record that my childhood bedroom in Chapel Hill is still painted Carolina blue. but you know, my Blue Devil peers also know that I'm a diehard Duke fan now, so I hope they can't hold that against me. So I did have to convert my freshman year. It's hard not to convert, though, when you go through the tenting experience in Krzyzewskiville and just get captivated by that energy. And it's almost impossible to shake and to not be a part of. So I did become, I'm a diehard Duke fan.
Okay, there you go. Well, yeah, I think every college does that. You know, you get there and they just sort of like, this is what you are now and this is what you identify with, and accept that. And they continue to tell you that all the way through whatever college you're going to. So when you get out, you are a fan and an alumni that will continue to support the school. And I think that's what it's all about there. So
very much so. Yeah. They're great community builders.
Yes. Yeah, they are. Well, that's one good thing about the universities. People don't understand that, they really do a lot for the community that they're in. I mean, a tremendous amount of stuff in the communities they're in. We're in Florida here. We got University of South Florida that's down in Tampa, and they're involved in so many things in Tampa that it's just amazing. So, yeah, I'm a fan of the schools that do that. So then you graduated from Duke and went to Oxford, University of Oxford?
I just did a term at Oxford, so it was during my undergraduate career, yeah.
Okay. And so then you did what?
Well, then I did a number of things. So I covered, before I graduated, this is kind of really what jump-started my journalism career was, I was a reporter at the Olympics in Beijing in 2008.
Oh, really?
I covered baseball and basketball.
All right. Well, speaking fluent Chinese, that would work very well. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, you know, it was interesting. I think I actually used more of my Spanish than my Chinese while I was there.
Really?
It was supposed to be the last year that baseball was going to be at the Olympics, and there was a whole issue with the Cuban team not being able to make it there, but none of the Cuban team spoke English very well, and so they threw me in whenever Cuba was playing. And so I actually think I might have used much more of my Spanish than, it was, you know, the language skills were certainly what allowed me to have that role, especially at such a young age. So that was a great experience. It was incredible. I met some really intelligent and just well-rounded people. It really makes you inspired by what people can do, both with their mind and their bodies. So really inspiring. And then for a little while, I was an intern and a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, where I covered economics. And I think that is how I ended up that is how I ended up doing what I'm doing now, which is not economics, but I was on the economics desk kind of as we were coming out of the recession, and we had pretty atrocious job numbers at the time. And I was deeply fascinated by, you know, in the States, we have this mantra that that education is the great lifter, right? So there's the social mobility that is enabled by higher education.
Right.
And so I thought it was really interesting why the numbers were showing that these highly educated people were coming out of the recession and still couldn't find jobs. And you know what that means for our social beliefs that education means social mobility, so and employment. So I kind of carved out this little niche of reporting for myself while I was there, looking at what was happening with the highly educated and why they couldn't find jobs. And so in that space, I guess I got the attention of those in education journalism. So I was then recruited by the Huffington Post to lead their new education section. And so I was enticed and curious about what that means. Becoming an editor in my early 20s was fascinating to me. So,
Oh, yeah, no doubt.
Yeah, so I went over to the Huffington Post. I was there for a couple of years. And then I went over to Real Clear Politics, which was launching an education section as well. And so they hired me to launch Real Clear Education. And from there, was brought on to the 74, which is a national nonprofit news site covering education. And I've been there now for 7 or 8 years. Now my day job I'm the director of multimedia and projects for the 74. But while all of this was happening, it was kind of in my early 20s that I'm really dissatisfied with my life and what I was doing. I think I needed to find other stimulation because I had been doing journalism for a very long time for a very young person. And I wasn't sure if I was disenchanted by the work or if I was disenchanted by any number of things. I just kind of needed to do a little bit of self-discovery. Mm-hmm. So I knew that I had always loved restaurants. I had followed all of the celebrity chefs. I probably spent more time reading, Grub Street and Eater and Bon Appetit than I did reading the publications that I worked for. And so I said, you know, I need to find some outlet that is productive. And whether it means I need to switch over completely, I just need to do some exploration. So I found out that Wiley Dufresne was opening a new restaurant called Alder, so second to WD50. And, you know, I applied. They were looking for a host, and so I sent in an application. I wrote a cover letter and a resume, and in the cover letter I said something along the lines of, like, I don't have any experience, but I work hard and will learn things. And
I really want to do this.
Yeah, just let me, please take me.
Yeah,
and
please.
Shockingly, I got a call back. And I went into the interview and I asked the general manager, Siobhan, thank God for her. I asked her why she bothered to bring me in for an interview. And she said, well, you wrote a cover letter. It was so wild to me, right? Because, I mean, now being on this side of restaurant hiring, I know how astonishing it is that there was a cover letter, because that's not, you know, you just throw out, you know, in restaurants, you just submit a resume and walk away and see what happens. And so
almost all businesses now, cover letters are really a thing of the past with resumes. I was taught to always submit a cover letter with your resume. But now, if a resume is any more than one page long, they frown upon it in everything. And the cover letter is always there to introduce yourself. And then you tell them, you know, just the basic info in the resume itself. So a cover letter is, I would think, would be almost a necessity in some of that stuff.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, that's, we always say at Silver Apricot, you know, the way that we hire here is we want to find right cultural fits. And a resume is not going to tell me that. A resume is going to tell me what you can do, but not who you are. And
exactly.
What's so important, I think, especially for small teams, it changes a little bit as you have a larger team or a larger company, but skills can be taught, but the people and their personalities cannot be. And so that's why I always feel like a cover letter just gives me a sense of who I'm dealing with.
No. And that makes sense. You know, it's like I say, cover letters used to be standard to, so you can learn a little bit about people. Now, you know, it's not that I need to apply for it, but I've talked to people on about resumes, and it's just so boring. look at a resume.
I had no idea that cover letters are becoming relic of the past.
They are. Oh, yeah, without question. It's just that people just don't sit down and tell about themselves. They just fill out the basic information. Resumes, to me, remind me of walking into a doctor's office and doctor hands you the clipboard and says, here, fill this out. And that, to me, reminds me of resumes now. Here, just fill out these basic information here, and you don't add anything to it to really tell about yourself. So, yeah. Oh, well, that's... And if I'm wrong, I'm sure somebody out there will inform me that I am wrong. But I... That's what I've noticed lately, though. Cover letters are really a relic of gone by days, I'm afraid to say. So, you got the job.
Yeah, I got the job. And then I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it. But, you know, it was also a host role. And it's kind of starting at the bottom when you're working at the front of house. And then I worked my way through all of the different roles as a runner, serving, and then that was kind of really where I started to care to learn about wine. I think that I had always enjoyed drinking wine, but when I had to talk about it, it was really different, you know, just to like it versus being able to have a conversation about it. And I'm also the kind of person that I hate not knowing things. I hate being, you know, I'm also always very upfront with when, like, things that I don't know, I'll say, I definitely don't know, but I can tell you what I do know. But I think that curiosity is what just kept feeding me through just absorbing so much more information about the wines that we were serving at Alder at the time. And then I ended up at a cheese and wine cafe that is now closed, unfortunately, called Casa Lula. It had been around for a really long time in Hell's Kitchen, and really started to hone in on wine there and cheeses. I was actually a fromager there too for a little while, so learned a lot about cheese. If anybody ever has any questions about cheese.
Cheese, you know your cheese. cheese is really, that's a lot to know about cheese. I've picked up different little pamphlets and books and all that and tried to educate myself a little bit because people, when I had the winery, people would say, well, what's a good cheese with this? And I'd go, yellow. So I try to do it. And, boy, I'll tell you, you can get yourself really quite submerged into the cheese knowledge.
Oh, yeah. You can dive in the deep end and get completely lost.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I always say, as with wine, when you're consuming, it's just there's no wrong answer. At the end of the day, if you're having a good time and you're enjoying it, then it's all good.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, then I was there for a couple of years and started thinking about going to business school. When an old friend of mine from Wiley's restaurants called me up Her name was Simone. She's my chef partner now at Silver Apricot. But our backstory, you know, we date back to Chef Wiley's restaurants. And she called me up one day and said, hey, I am doing a pop-up to pressure test my concept for this restaurant that I want to open. Please come. And I said, great, I would love to come, but also let me know if you need help. I know pop-ups can be a lot of work. And she said, no worries. I have a handle on it. Just buy a ticket and bring a friend, come and have fun. The day before the pop-up, she calls me again. And she says, so about your offer, I need help.
Lots. Come now.
So I showed up the next day and basically helped run the pop-up. There were, you know, I think we did something like 100 covers, and, you know, there were just a few of us. And kind of the rest is history. We realized that we worked really well together, and she brought me on to help manage and be a partner in the Little Tong Noodle Shops, which we opened three of until all three of them closed during the pandemic. But we had already started to work on a new concept called Silver Apricot, and that was supposed to open in March of 2020. For obvious reasons, there were some complications with that. But, you know, we had already worked on the space. We had already worked on the menu. We already had a team in place. And so, you know, I don't have to go through or explain the devastation that every restaurant owner or manager had experienced when shutting things down at the height of COVID. Fortunate in, it was, oh my gosh, so many tears and so many cries for help. And it was really sad. It was really, really sad. But we were in a fortunate position that we did have this other concept where we were able to move some of our previous team members over and keep them employed. We did kind of drag out the closing of the Little Tongs, because we were very fortunate to work with an organization called Rethink Food, which during the pandemic created community kitchens in restaurants. And so through the support of a grant from Rethink Food, we kept many of our team on payroll, producing hundreds of meals a day for frontline workers and for those in need.
Fantastic.
Yeah, it was a really great way to be able to, one, make sure that we could preserve the livelihoods of some of our staff, and also be able to serve the community in a time of need.
That's great.
Yeah, so we were then able to bring some of them over to Silver Apricot when we were finally able to open in June of 2020. It was a totally wild ride. And the original concept for Silver Apricot was supposed to be a Chinese-American fine dining concept. We were looking at a tasting menu. But when during a pandemic and a recession, it felt really tone deaf to do anything like that. So we completely pivoted the concept to something a lot more casual, something that really served the neighborhood more than a fine dining establishment would as a destination spot. So we've iterated that concept many times since we opened, but we are now still a a la carte, upscale casual spot. We are new American Chinese focused, and with that have an all domestic wine and beer list and sake list, which is something that I think a lot of guests, when they come for the first time, are a little surprised by. I think they're so used to the classics and their old world wines that they come and they don't really get why we don't have Burgundy or or Tuscan wines, you know. So, But it felt like it made sense with the through line of the story that we were telling at Silver Apricot of being, you know, American Chinese and the stories of immigrants that are doing their work here.
How? A whole bunch of questions. Okay, first one. Little Tong Noodle Shop was in the East Village. I am not that familiar with New York City. Where is the East Village?
The East Village is in the lower eastern part of Manhattan. Lower middle eastern, eastern part of Manhattan. That was the first location of Little Tong.
Okay, and then Silver Apricot is in the West Village. That is where?
Almost a straight shot west of the East Village.
Okay, I'm not familiar with New York and, you know, the stuff like that. Now, are you a certified sommelier?
I am.
When
fortunately
did you...
and unfortunately.
Why unfortunately?
It's a pretty grueling process, I think.
It is. Oh, yeah.
Definitely lost a lot of hair.
When did you get your certification? When did you do all that?
I want to say it was 2019. I can't remember exactly, but I want to say it was 2018 or 2019.
Yeah, so you actually did it right before the pandemic hit us.
Yes, it was before the pandemic. It was also shortly after Fred Dame had retired from the court. So whenever that was, because that I remember this distinctly because I remember him retiring. And then I said, great, thank God. There's no chance that he's going to be on the examination board because he just retired. And then he came out of retirement just to be on the board of that examination.
I think we lost Ron, or I lost somebody. Ron,
I'm
are you there?
Here.
I hear you. Okay.
Can you guys hear me?
Yes, I hear you. Do you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
Okay. I think Ron, we lost you. If you're out there, might try calling in. We've been having some severe weather, and I don't know if that got him or not.
I see.
But I know his part of Florida has been getting hit in the center part. But okay. I didn't catch what was his name? Fred?
Fred,
on the board?
Yeah. Fred Dame was one of the proctors of my exam. That I was just trying to date. I was trying to remember the date because I just remember it being shortly after he announced that he was retiring from the court.
Okay. But it's, I don't know. I guess I just got the impression that it was a good thing that he was retiring from it, but he came back and that wasn't a good thing.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well,
okay.
he's been known to be a tough cookie. So.
Okay. All right. All right. That's about it. Okay, gotcha. Let's try this. I guess he must have lost his laptop, too. Ron, are you there?
No, I'm only on here. I'm not there at all. I don't know why I disappeared.
Okay, I can hear you on your phone. I guess you called in on your phone, but I don't hear you the other way. Okay, you're live. Yeah, you're on.
Yeah, am I on? Can everybody
yes.
hear me?
Yes,
welcome back.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I called in on my phone, my headset. Well, it's showing no internet on my screen here, so excuse me. So I don't know what happened. But good. At least I'm there.
There
it finally shows my phone. All right. Blog Talk Radio drives us nuts sometimes. That's what we get for live shows, you know. No, don't edit her. You asked a good question about him leaving and coming back. I was going to go into that too when my headset went beep, boop, beep, and that was it. I didn't hear anybody, so I don't know what happened there. So you you became a sommelier. Have you, well, of course, you put it into practice. The wines that you have at Silver Apricot, what are they? It is a diverse list of wines, and like you say, it's not the ones that you normally see when you walk in the restaurants or stuff. What, well, both of questions. Number one, why did you decide to do what you did? And two, what are the wines that you're having? And three, we've talked about sake on the show before. Obviously, you're knowledgeable in that, so we need to talk about sake also. So why did you decide to go the way you did?
Yeah, it was frankly kind of an easy decision. When I conceived of it, I was a little nervous when I went to talk to Simone about it, but she said that she loved the idea. And I decided to go that route because of the ethos of the restaurant and the food. You know, to celebrate Chinese American cuisine as its own thing also meant that you're celebrating being American, being ethnic in America. And I think that there's so many wonderful things happening in the wine world in the U.S. that I think isn't being celebrated enough. I think that there is a huge prestige and price tag that comes with a lot of the stuff from the old world, of which we don't even need to name today. They're pretty well known. That, you know, whether they are valid or not doesn't really matter, right? But I think that a lot, and the more that you listen to, there are so many immigrant winemakers in the U.S. that often have a common thread of when you ask them why they came to the States to make wine rather than in their home countries, because many of them also come from winemaking regions.
Right.
And they often say, well, it's because of the innovation and the creativity that is allowed to happen here. They're often not given that latitude in their home countries and wine growing regions. Mm-hmm. So it, to me, just feels like so much of this through line of an American dream, but from a different lens, right? Where they're coming here to seek out a different type of opportunity. And they're doing some really great things with it. And I think that like they're the ones that are really shaping how to rethink and to relook at wine. So, you know, our list really features a lot of those wines that are coming from folks that are really just treating it differently and thinking about it a little differently.
So your wines are coming from, you know, winemakers that a lot of them are immigrants, but what regions of this country are you seeking them?
We've got everything. You know, we have wines from, you know, the obvious ones like California, and right. You know, New York Finger Lakes. But we also have wines from Texas. We have some blueberry wine from Maine, which is like super cool. We have wine from Pennsylvania and New Jersey. I'm looking forward to putting something on from North Carolina, but you know, we haven't gotten there yet. So we really are, you know, we have some stuff from Wisconsin and Minnesota. And I think that when folks see that on a wine list, they're intimidated or they kind of shoot it down because, you know, there can't be good wine from Minnesota. What are you talking about? Jersey Shore wine? No way, right? but when you start to really learn more about the ethos of these wines and why they exist, and you really learn about the stories behind them and you taste them, I think people are often pleasantly surprised.
Oh, I don't have any doubt that they are. I've had wines from every state in the nation. When I had the winery, I asked people to bring a wine in from a different state, and I ended up collecting all 50 states, plus some, you know, duplicates and some extras and all that. But it's just amazing the quality of wine that's being made in this country. And what so often happens is that, like Texas. All the wines they make are usually consumed in Texas because they can't keep up with the demand. And so it's hard to find Texas wines here in Florida or anywhere else. So I kudos to you for doing that. I think that's a great, great thing to do.
Thank you. I hope so. I mean, I've been so pleasantly surprised. And frankly, we've been able to develop so many personal relationships with these winemakers because of this. You know, I think that we're all supporting each other. Many of them are very small production producers. So I think it's a really cool thing. When you have your domestic wines, were there any, can you think of anything that really stood out to you?
Nevada. And I'm sad to say that the company that produced it is no longer in business, but I got a wine from, oh, I get a blank now. Jeez. Well, I can't think of the name of it, but the winery closed down. But that was great wine. I had a couple from Nevada that are fantastic. Also, Arizona, the standard ones that you find that's up in northern Arizona. But I visited a lot of wineries in southern Arizona that are phenomenal. The elevation, what really surprised me when I was heading to the wineries there, heading south to the wineries, we had driven past the immigrant check station. They have them on the roads there, and you got to show IDs and all this stuff. We had driven south of that, and then there was this enormous sign on the side of the road, "Welcome to Wine Country." And you're going, what? I didn't turn to California. What is it? You know, it seems so odd to see the sign. And there's a dozen wineries out there, and they're just phenomenal. They have great flavors, great taste. They don't ship in the summer because it's just so bloody hot down there, but they have some phenomenal wines in southern Arizona. I've had some wines in Minnesota and Wisconsin. I always put out some good cold weather wines that are rather unique. Some wineries in Missouri too that are really, really quite good. And people, when you start thinking about these different places, people start thinking about muscadine, but all these places are growing, you know, vinifera grapes that are thriving and doing a great job there, and they're doing a great job of making the wine from them. So just those particular states I just found that jump out in my mind. So, and to think of wineries, I'd have to search my brain a little bit here because some, you know, if I don't think about it every day, I tend to forget. and that's going to drive me nuts now about that one in Nevada that I like. Pahrump Winery was very good. They have closed down since then, I'm sad to say, but they put out a Cabernet Sauvignon that it was a Zinfandel, one of the first Zinfandels in the state of Nevada, and they did a phenomenal job on that. I was so impressed with it. But, you know, I can keep saying it's sad to say they closed. But I think it's fantastic that you're getting wines from these little-known regions and little-known wineries and winemakers. It's something that I would love to see happen all over the country. And you have a great place to do that there in New York. I think that's fantastic.
Thank you. I also have to correct myself. We do have, because it's so new, I forgot, we just started to carry North Carolina wine. So out of Asheville, North Carolina. Yeah, it is, you know, it is really fun. And I agree with you. What's really cool too, is that some of these lesser known wine regions have winemakers that are doing things with grape varietals that are probably lesser known or definitely lesser known and less utilized. So, you know, there's a maker, Camuna Cellars, which is based in Philly, is using grapes from Jersey and like Pennsylvania and really searching for things that are local and not just, I think their DNA is that, you know, we're not going to try to just plant vinifera for sake of planting vinifera. You know, the thought is what if we actually created the wine culture in the States, much like it is in Europe, for example, where wine is just like your agricultural beverage. It's not this luxury good that is touted because of, you know, what it's made from. So
Right. They're
really looking at like localization and what actually grows well where they are. And making wines from that. And I think it's so cool. And it's so of the moment.
Yeah, that is fantastic. And so many places around the country, I'm sure you're well aware of, has wine shipped from California. And and they say, oh, I've got this here and I've got this here. And then you start looking at it and say, well, this juice is from California. What are you doing locally? And there's so many local grapes in areas that are just unique, and they taste people search for the what they're used to, the Cabs, Merlots, the Chardonnays, the Rieslings. And if it's not those, then they immediately have an attitude about the wine. And it's really sad because, like you say, they're doing so much with the wines that are not from California, are not the vinifera style, that they're putting together some very, very good wines in areas that you wouldn't expect. So I've talked about this a lot of times on the show about, you know, try your local wines, try something new. And it's good that you're doing it. The wines that you are serving in the restaurant, telling the story when you serve them? Are you explaining to the people that these are from small wineries from such and such a place and this is what it's all about?
We do when they're willing to listen, but not everybody's here for a conversation.
That's true. Yeah. Well, when they come in to eat, some people just want to eat. Now, do you find that your domestic wines, say from Wisconsin, are matching well with Chinese foods?
They're doing great. And they're really, really cool. And, you know, for what it's worth, you know, our food is modern, you know, Chinese American. So I think that's when folks think about Chinese American food, they think of Chinese takeout, you know, like
right.
Panda Express. But what we're doing is a lot of stuff that's, you know, either inspired by that or, you know, the whole story of being Chinese in America is a lot of, you know, when I was growing up in North Carolina, for example, my parents, you know, they knew how to cook how they knew how to cook, right, which was Chinese.
Right.
But now you have access to so many things, but then you didn't, right? And so where were we getting our produce and where were we getting our proteins from? It was going to be like the local farmer's market and the local butcher. And the farmer's market in North Carolina doesn't have bok choy or Chinese broccoli. You know, they're carrying collards and okra. So it was this whole exploration of new ingredients, but cooking them the way that they knew how to cook. And so that's kind of a lot of what we're doing at Silver Apricot they weren't alone, obviously, right? There was a whole generation of these immigrants that were cooking this way here. And I know that this story is not unique to the Chinese American experience. I'm sure it's very common across other nationalities and ethnicities as well. So, when I think that, you know, a lot of folks probably confuse us or they like to say that we're quote unquote fusion. But to me, fusion is a lot more of an intentional mishmashing of two or three types of cuisines. Whereas I find that what we're doing is a lot more of an organic approach, where it really does come from just being in a place and using those ingredients that you have access to, but cooking them in the way that you know how.
Very good. Yes, a good explanation of that. And I like that. It's, I mean, if you don't have the ingredients, you're going to have to use what you have there. So you just think, actually, it's almost like creating a new style of food itself, new prep style itself, because you don't have the ingredients you used to, but you're still doing the same basic thing. So, yeah, very good. That sounds like it would be a great menu. How many, do you serve a la carte? I think I read somewhere where the menu is a la carte.
Yeah, we are all a la carte. We have like a family style option that is a set menu if folks come with larger parties. And, you know, in Chinese culture, everything is family style, right? So that's an opportunity to get a little immersive if that's the way that folks want to go.
Oh, okay. Now, off the subject of food for a second. And I don't know if you know, if you're knowledgeable or not, but the Chinese wine market, it seems to be exploding now, and they're getting wines from all over the world, plus everything that they're producing and, you know, all that. Do you have any knowledge of the Chinese wine market?
I have rudimentary knowledge of the Chinese wine market. There's a lot of wealth. There is a lot of luxury in China right now. But they're also becoming a lot more knowledgeable as wine buyers. I think that the wine buyer in China right now is very different from the wine buyer in China 10, 20 years ago, for sure. They're certainly bringing in a larger number of boutique wines. And I definitely know of some winemakers that are actually being distributed, like smaller production winemakers that are being distributed in China right now. So I definitely think that the average Chinese winemaker is, or sorry, the average Chinese wine buyer is a lot more discerning and dynamic than it was a couple of decades ago when I think that they knew a lot about the luxury wines and the big box stuff. Now I think there are so many, you know, there's a much larger scale, graduating scale of the kind of person that's buying wine there now. It's also a much more global economy, and I think that they're experiencing more and seeing more of both the world and the wines that are in the world. So I definitely think that there's some really intelligent but also powerful buyers.
A lot more of a disposable income, and so therefore the higher end wines are being purchased. The reason I was asking, we had guests on the show, we had a cigar show, and the guys were, you know, all cigar bloggers and stuff, and they knew a lot about cigars, and I continued to correspond with them and talk with them and all that. And last night we were talking about how cigars have taken over in China, how there's so many cigars being imported to China from Cuba and Dominican Republic and all that. And general consensus was basically from the guys was about the same thing you said, you know, a new money, new discerning palates and cigars and stuff. And it's really taken off. And I made the parallel to wine. And I just wondered if I was wrong. Obviously, I wasn't, because from what you just said, this is what is happening over there, not just with wine, but with cigars. And I think a lot of other higher-end stuff is affecting China markets and regions. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, I mean, I'm just jealous. What would it be like to be able to buy wine without a budget?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yeah. That would make me jealous. Yeah. That's very true. I had another question. I slipped. Maybe Mike. Mike, do you have any questions or comments? Emily?
Not at this time. I'm good. Thank you. Very interesting. Mm-hmm. But
yeah.
I haven't.
I was hoping you'd ask something, because I was trying to think of what I was going to ask, and I lost it then when we talked about China. I remember. Sake. you serve sake? Okay.
We do serve sake.
Sake?
Yes.
Is that is it sake? Okay, well, I've been saying it wrong my whole life. is your sake from Japan, China, or is it domestic?
Domestic as well.
Is it?
And
okay.
We, you know, there's a sake brewer in Brooklyn called Brooklyn Kura, and they are doing some really great things. Just down the street from us, kind of. So we really feature them pretty prominently on our sake list.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know there was a sake brewer in Brooklyn. How many different types of sake are you on your menu?
We have four different, I mean, forgive me for using a wine term for this, but four what they would call cuvées, right? So there's so many other different types and varieties of it, you know, but right now everything is coming from Brooklyn Kura. There's also a sake brewer in Asheville, North Carolina. We haven't been able to get them by distribution, but they're really great. And I think there were actually some down in Florida and Texas or something like that along the Gulf as well.
Yeah, there's, I think one in Florida, since you mentioned it, and I can't remember the name or where. There is definitely one in Texas, I think. Pennsylvania? Ohio? I can't remember exactly where. Well, but yeah, they're popping up all over. Sake brewers are just speckled throughout the country, I think. Because it's becoming more and more popular and definitely market. I am a fan myself. I actually have four or five bottles sitting on my wine rack here of sake.
So, oh, I love that.
I'm sorry?
I said I love that.
Yeah, it's just as much part of my wine rack as, you know, anything else. Sake is right there with it, so. Not something that I usually look as a meal type drink, which I don't know. Am I wrong? Do you serve it after the meal or during the meal or what?
I don't think there's any wrong answer. You know, I feel if you're enjoying it, enjoy it however you like to have it. You know, I personally don't really drink sake alone, but that's just a personal preference. You know, I love acidity in my beverages. And so to me, sake alone doesn't have enough perceivable acidity. And so that's why I love it with food to create that like perfect, well-rounded palate, I guess. But there's also like, I think sake is great for, it's great as an aperitif. It's great with a meal. It's great with dessert. You know, you can have it however you like to have it.
Yeah. I usually have it just an aperitif, and it tends to sharpen the palate for the meal. And so that's usually why I do have the sake before. But I'll have to try it with the meal. I just never have, and not for any particular reason. Just I've always thought that it might screw the flavors of the meal too much, or even the sake. So I have to go back and give it a try now.
You definitely should. Yeah, it's interesting because sake has, you know, because it is made from rice and yeast and water, it has a lot less of that perceivable acid that we know so well as acid.
Right.
But it has a different type of acid. It has a different type of acid, which is the same one that is responsible for the sensation, the umami sensation. So, like, and also the lactic acid produced from that fermentation gives it that creaminess and texture. So, to me, like, a great sake is almost like a great dirty martini, you know, that has like salinity, viscosity, floral qualities, and a little bit of sweetness.
Good comparison. Yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that it pairs well with things that are that tend to have higher that has higher perceivable acidity, and for things that like and with things that are very like umami rich.
Mm-hmm. Wow, good comparison. I will have to start searching out that then instead of just using it for my aperitif.
I think you should give it a shot with some grilled cheese and tomato soup.
Okay, I will make a note of that, and definitely goat cheese and tomato soup.
Grilled cheese and tomato soup.
Oh, grilled cheese and tomato soup. Well, grilled cheese and tomato soup is always good. I'm not one to dip my grilled cheese into the tomato soup like so many are so inclined. I just do, but I will have to try that sake grilled cheese and tomato soup. That sounds like that would be good. Yeah, and the acid and the tomatoes and all that. Well, there you go. So I will give that a try. Well, Emmeline, any last thoughts or comments or anything? And also, give us some information, contact information for the Silver Apricot in case anyone wants to get in touch or stop by, or if they need reservations, or your Facebook and all that other good stuff.
Yeah, of course. Our website is silverapricot.nyc. All of our contact information and menu and availability is all there. And we're on Instagram, so follow us on Instagram. It's silverapricotnyc.
NYC, that's a new one to me. I don't think I've heard that. Why not? I mean, it's New York City. Yes. That's great. Thank you so much for taking time to visit with us today and this evening. It was really a pleasure. Learned a lot. And, yeah, best of wishes to the Silver Apricot and to you in your future adventures. And maybe someday in the future we can get you back on and see how things are going then and see what's happening with the restaurant business at that time.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure. And let me know if you're ever in New York.
Oh, I will definitely plan on doing a stop on the west side now that I know where it is.
Please do.
Okay. And thank you for your time. And have a good evening now.
Thank you. You too.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You.
Yeah. All right.
Okay.
Well,
there you go.
My stinking connection broke off on me.
All of a sudden?
Yeah, it did. I was sitting here and she's talking and I'm going, can you hear me? Mike? Emmeline? Anybody? And nothing. So
it just got quiet and we're both sitting here like, okay. That's when I decided to yell. Didn't hear anything. And I go, uh-oh, here we are. I don't know if you could hear what she was saying. Yeah, you were gone.
Okay. Yeah, I was gone. And not, you know, and you did a good job of picking that up about the sommelier and doing that. Yeah, that was just going to be my next question anyway. I heard her say that, and that's when I lost it. So you did good. Then I grabbed the phone, and I called in, and I'm going, oh, no, it's not connecting, you know, on the show. And then she said, yeah, we can hear you. So, yeah, good. So when they ask me to vote how this went tonight, I'll give them a bad rating, you know. But it says no internet. I don't know why that says that. That's just crazy.
On your laptop, interesting. Maybe you lost a connection or something. I don't know.
So I don't know. I went over here to something else, and I clicked on it, and it's coming up. So it's not like it disappeared. I mean, it's still got internet here. Castle Ridge Winery, here's the old thing from them. That popped up. I don't know why it's saying it lost the internet. Let's go back to Blog Talk. Yeah, it says no internet on the screen. It's, you know, our main screen on the studio. It just shows no internet. But we're still talking and it didn't connect us. So, and I'm the host, so if we have no internet, it would have disconnected us. So.
Yeah, you would have been disconnected as a host. So.
Yeah. Oh. Oh well. So, interesting life for a young lady. She's in her mid 30s. We found, and oh my gosh, she's really, really
very many accomplishments.
Yes, and inspirational for people who say, "Oh, what am I going to do?" Well, she just jumped in and did it. So,
yeah,
that's a good thing. Before we go, we have to promote Flightline Radio.
No,
Mike's radio show, radio program, radio format. What do we call it?
It's just doing what I do. Music. I did some music. Yeah, I don't know. Music news last time. I did some on that. I was thinking on making up stories about different songs or groups. I don't know. Just throw like a little.
There you go.
I mean, at the end of it. Didn't just at the end of it say, "Oh, it's all made up." I just made it up. But
snippets.
Yeah. But it's just a show. Take requests and play music and give some information out and whatever. But
He talks. And he's live Friday evening from 7 to 9. You said you were looking at changing that live time. Okay. Are you going to?
I don't know.
Oh, okay. Okay. Not to put you on the spot, but you mentioned that you were looking at changing.
Yeah, so far it's working out. It's been okay, but I don't know. I might try and change a day or add another show just to mix things up a little bit. But,
well, there you go. That would be cool. But right now, live on Lifetime Radio, 7 to 9 Friday evenings, Mike is on the air, and then you can listen to Flightline Radio anytime because it's 24-hour streaming. So you can tune in and listen to it at any time. But if you have any special requests or a song that you haven't heard and like, oh, my gosh, I haven't heard that in so long, I want to hear it, you can't find it, Mike has it. You'll find it somewhere for you. So, be sure to tune in on him and tomorrow night, 7 to 9 on Flightline Radio.
And don't forget Ron's extra gig, the cigar. What did they call it? Cigar shows? Cigar people sitting around with the
wine
guy?
Yeah, we just sit around and talk. Okay. Well, just any of the cigar guys. Craig does snippets from our conversation and puts it on a podcast, or I don't know exactly what he does with it, but he'll edit it and put it on. So. That's always good, but you can always, listen to the cigar guys. They all have their thing going for them, so.
Yeah.
Do that.
Give them some shout-outs. Wow, we are 8 minutes behind on the feed. There's no way I'm waiting for that. As soon as the video's done, I'm done. Probably
it's just showing 8 o'clock is all. Oh, my gosh.
Eight. Turning to 8:01 now, but I think in the future we should give a shout out to Craig and obviously Kaplowitz. He's been on the show four times.
Did he get I think he's tied right now. And then we got Phil Switch. Tune into that. Phil Switch is just cigars and laughter and music and a little bit of comedy. And then Mike Weinstein reviews cigars almost daily on Cap's Facebook page. So tune into Cap's Facebook page and Mike reviews cigars. So they're all, quite into cigars. It was interesting, like I was telling Emmeline last night, we were talking about cigars and I think it was Craig that mentioned something about how China is starting to just get as many Cuban cigars shipped over there as they possibly can. They've got this idle money that they don't know what to do with. And, the reputation of Cuban cigars is bringing it in. And same thing with some other regions, Nicaragua and Dominican Republic. I mentioned that wine was that way over there. And Emmeline actually confirmed that in her comments there. So, but big market over there in China for all that stuff, So,
nice. All right. Well, we'll follow Kaplowitz Media at kaplowitz.xyz. That's K-A-P-L-O-W-I-T-Z. Kaplowitz? L-O-W-I-T-Z. Yeah. .xyz. Check it out. And
oh,
to the show.
Before we get off, too, let's see. Yeah, I'll be here next week. I'm going to be flying up to Atlanta to see my grandson's First Communion. I guess that's what it is. But that won't be until the morning after. It'll probably be the morning after the show. So I'll be here next week. I think we have a guest next week, too.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure we do. I'm sitting here in the dark, and I can't see my calendar anyway. So, but yeah, check the information page, and Mike will post our guest for next week. I think this is from Southern Wine and Spirits. Well, I'm sitting here talking. I'm going to have to look it up. So
find it, and we'll post it at some point. We'll let them know.
Let me look right now and be sure. Let's see, February, March, April,
May the 4th.
May the be with you. May the 4th. No, Eric's not going to be on until the 18th, so my mistake. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The 18th he's going to be on. So the 4th, we don't have a guest. So you can all tune in anyway, but we don't have a guest. And if Kath's listening to this, Kath will say, I want to break my record. And but tune in next week. We'll be here and have the information on the wine and everything. So
have a good week
out there. Yeah.
And enjoy your intro to May coming up next week. So thank you.
That's
and
right.
Be safe.
Be safe.
Want y'all back.
May Day coming up too. So.
Yeah. Have a good night. We'll be up.
Yep. Thanks for listening.
This concludes tonight's broadcast of All About Wine with your host, Juan. For show information, links to All About Wine on Twitter and Facebook, or to be a guest on this show, visit the show website at www.allaboutwine.com. Archive shows are available for download on iTunes or on our show page at blogtalkradio.com/allaboutwine. Thank you for listening. Drink responsibly, and we'll see you next time on All About Wine.
All About Wine.
There we go. And off of there.
And there we go.
There, I am ending.
All right. How far are you behind on Facebook now?
I signed off. I turned the video off.
There you go.
It was 8 minutes. It was 8 minutes. But what was interesting?
We were just chit-chatting anyway.
Let me drag you over to. Let me just turn this off. I'll drag you over to the green room.
I can control it.
Oh, you.
Uh-oh.
There was a problem. I wonder if we can't. Yeah, we can.